Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. And if you're a guitar player who's looking to make some more money, then listen very closely to what I'm about to tell you. If you're a guitar player or any other kind of musician for that matter, or if you know a musician who wants to make some more money without having to tour or go on the road or put up with any of the other BS musicians normally have to deal with, then you need to download this new special report about how to make a small fortune by licensing your music. And by licensing music, I mean getting your music inserted into movies, television shows, and commercials. The report is less than 20 pages long, and it was written by Mike Elsner, who I interviewed in episode number 167 of this show. Mike's been doing this for over 14 years, and he's had over 2,000 songs licensed at this point in time. That means he's getting paid to license almost 150 songs per year. Now, keep in mind, most successful career musicians don't get paid for 150 songs in total over a 30 or 40 year career. Yet Mike's getting paid for this on an annual basis. And the cool thing about this business is that you can run it from your own home studio and you'll never have to deal with ivory tower record label executives telling you what to play and how to play it, and no shady managers or unethical business people telling you what to do either. So download Mike's free ebook on the 4-step plan to licensing success right now. Just go to everyonelovesguitar.com/Mike. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/Mike, M-I-K-E. Let me know how you like the book. And now let's get on with the show. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. I'm here with a really strong session player. He's with the Opry now, and he's just been around a long time. And he's a very talented guitarist. We're with Mike Noble. Mike moved to Nashville in the early 70s, and he immediately began touring with, check this out, Roy Orbison, Dave Loggins, and Lynn Anderson. In the early 80s, he decided to get off the road, and he stayed in Nashville to pursue songwriting and session work. He secured a writing contract. What's that? With Warner Brothers Music, a relationship that lasted until 2000. And in that time, he wrote hits for Steve Warner, Lee Greenwood, Brooks and Dunn, and Kenny Rogers. He also gained a reputation of being a solid studio musician, and he moved from playing on publishers' demos to master sessions. He's worked with such artists as Kenny Rogers, Highway 101, Restless Heart, and more recently, Jason Aldean. He joined the Opry family in 2012 as an acoustic guitarist, and he's an integral part of their family now, and he also doubles on banjo and harmonica. Mike, I know you're busy. Thank you for your time. Appreciate you coming on the show.
No, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for asking me. I appreciate it.
Hey, so you've been in town a while, and I know that you've seen tons of changes.
Yeah.
Both in Nashville and in the music system process and all that stuff. What are the biggest changes musically in the Nashville of today versus when you got there in the early 70s?
Well, when I got here in the early 70s, although there was a good old boy network in place that was referred to, it was still a time where you could literally walk down Music Row with your guitar and cassette tapes of a couple of your songs. And often you could wander into a publishing company, and if the guy that ran the place wasn't doing anything, staring at the ceiling, you could actually get in and play a song for somebody that could actually get it recorded. I mean, it was a very open door policy. They were looking for interesting new talent. These days, it's like all other businesses. It's very, very, very inside. An artist and their management company these days control everything. I mean, they own the artist in what they call a 360. That's a normal contract these days where they own the records, they own the artist, they own their publishing, they control what material they record and who records it and who has the publishing. They even own their merchandise and stuff. And so it's a lot tighter family. If you happen to be inside that family, if you're inside Tim McGraw's family, that's a good thing for you. You've got a real shot of getting something out there. But if you're just a guy off the street that's got a great song that came here from Des Moines, Iowa, your chances are really, really, really slim. So it's a lot tighter scene. And the music is different. Back then, it was much more traditional country. You know, it was much more three-chord country stuff. And now it's a much more pop, you know. And I'm not saying that's all bad. I'm just saying it's so different.
It's different, yeah.
It's different. I learn a lot of tunes to play for the people that come through the Opry, and it's a lot more, our chord charts are a lot more complicated. There's a lot more going on in these records than there was back when George Jones had, you know, He Stopped Loving Her Today. And so it's just a, it's a different world, Greg, as you know, it's a, and the music reflects that. So it's a lot more cosmopolitan. It's a lot harder to break into the inner circle. There's a lot more traffic here and everything's a lot more complicated. It, in those days, it was really like, a small big town, a little big town. Matter of fact, there's even a band that calls itself that after the, those old days. And now it's very, very cosmopolitan. So we have all the, we all have all the stuff here that cities always want to get. We have major league teams and a nice hockey team and a foot major league football. And we also has have all the stuff that comes with that, which is a lot of folks, yeah. You know. And so it's different that way. But when I came, it was I was a lot younger, a lot more wide-eyed. And it was a more innocent place, actually.
Sure.
It really was.
It's funny when you said that about you could walk into a publishing house. I had interviewed, like, one of my earliest interviews with Walter Carter
from
Vintage. And,
sure.
And that's what he said he did. He came here and he walked into a, he bumped into a guy on the street and he,
right.
That's how he got, like, his publishing contract or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that really happened. And he wasn't the only one, really. There are stories of, well-known writers that really they just showed up with a guitar, $400, and they wandered up and down Music Row. And Music Row in those days was a series of two streets, 16th and 17th Avenue, that run parallel to each other for a mile and a half. That was just chock full of publishing companies, recording studios. It was like where everything was happening. And yeah, you literally could wander in, and if the guy that was the publisher inside wasn't doing anything, somebody like Bob Montgomery or something, he'd go, "All right, I'm not doing anything. What do you got?" And you'd sit down and play something, and they go like, "Close, no cigar, or what else you got?" You know, I can't imagine that happening. These and Music Row is a different place. It's mostly high rise condos now. The
yeah.
music business is, has it's off Music Row now. It's. Mm. But anyway, it was a different time, and I'm not saying it was any better. It was just different.
Sure.
And certainly was more accessible, you know, which was good for some kid moving from Cedarville, Illinois to Nashville to say, like, hey, you know, I'm going to come down there and start the Beatles, you know?
Yeah. How'd you get the gig working with Roy Orbison, and, like, what was your experience like with that, and are there any cool stories that you have?
Oh, yeah, it was great. I'd been here a few weeks. I moved down here. After high school, I moved to Colorado, and anyway, I had to go in the service for a while, but I had a couple of friends that I played in high school bands with that had dropped out of college and moved here to be songwriters, which was weird to me because I never considered Nashville as a music source for where I was going. I grew up playing Beatles and Kinks and Stones and all of that stuff. I knew very little about country music. Yet these guys had, this guy, one guy in particular, had figured out that if you wanted to be a songwriter, Nashville was the place to be. So he dropped out of college, second year, moved to Nashville, and he was actually getting some things going. So when I got out of the service, I had nothing going on. Everybody was away at college. So I came down to Nashville just to visit him. I had a car and my duffel bag, you know, and I stayed. That was 1973. I came down here, I stayed, and he was hooked up with a few people that had a few things bubbling. One was a promising songwriter named Dave Loggins. One was a promising session player named Steve Gibson that was already playing on Master 21. And he introduced me to these guys. And anyway, we kind of had a band of brothers. There were six or eight of us wandering in that would chip in and buy a couple six packs of beer and sit around and play all night. We played Dave Loggins' new songs. Well, Steve Gibson was working for Roy Orbison's publishing company. He was doing demos for Roy had a very strong publishing company. And he had found out, they'd asked Steve if he wanted to go out and do a couple of dates with Roy. Steve couldn't do it. He said, but he told him, he said, "I know a guy that just moved to town. He's a real strong electric guitar player. Call this guy." So that's how it happened. They asked for Steve Gibson. They couldn't get Steve. Steve referred me. I just moved to town. I knew Roy Orbison because my sister wore out Pretty Woman. We had the record at my house. And Roy was in a very, very much lull in his career at that time. He'd really lost his popularity in the United States, and most of his work was coming from Europe in those days. This was before Tom Petty and Bruce Springsteen had gone and got him and pulled him up and said, "Here's an American treasure. You need to honor him." This was a dull time. So he had one date in Toronto, Canada, and it was at Maple Leaf Stadium, and it was a rock and roll revival. And I flew up there with him and his band. I didn't meet Roy till I got to the gig. And so we're in Maple Leaf Stadium. And, you know, I just kind of had, I'd never played a gig like this. I didn't even know what to expect. So I had my guitar and I look out and I see 13,000 people, screaming people. And I was a nervous wreck. And Roy was backstage and Terry, his bass player, said, "Roy, this is Mike Noble. He's playing guitar with you." And he goes like, "Hi, Mike." And he looks at me, he goes, "It's going to be okay." He could tell I was a nervous wreck. So the weird story is this. My job on stage was, after I plugged myself in, when they introduced Roy, I was supposed to hand him his cool guitar, that Gretsch body with the Gibson neck that he had made. I get up on stage, the band's in place, they introduce Roy Orbison, screaming fans. Roy walks on stage and I freeze. I forget to hand him his guitar. I mean, I was like a deer. I was totally a deer in the headlights. I just was, my jaw dropped. And Terry goes, Mike, give Roy the guitar. So finally, I did. So 15 minutes later, I'm playing da 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 da. So that whole night, like me, is like a flash in a dream. So that's the only date I did with Roy. It was phenomenally successful. For me, it was like playing with the Beatles. 13,000 fans. And in Canada, they still appreciated Roy and all of his hits. And after that, we flew back. And the rest of my tenure with Roy for the next 6 months was I got to play on some of his publishing demos. He was an active publisher, and he had songwriters in Nashville that were writing and recording songs to pitch to artists. And that was the only actual date I did with him, but I was in his band for 6 months. So that's how that happened.
So you're sitting there on stage. Could you even process that? Like, you know, 2 weeks ago, you just came out of the service and you're
I couldn't. I mean, it was too unreal. And it was so much bigger than I thought it was going to be, because I guess I had fallen into that lethargy that the United States was like, yeah, he had some great records. He was cool. But that was, you know, 63. And it's now, that was 10 years ago, which seemed like a lifetime at that time.
When you're that age, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so I had no idea of the magnitude of his popularity, and I had never faced, I don't think I'd ever faced 1,300 people playing a gig, let alone 13,000, but it was a big rock and roll show. I don't even remember who else was there. That whole night to me, Craig, is like a blur, because it was so unreal that like I was having an out-of-body experience. It was all I could do to play the licks that I was expected to play.
Did you even hear him? Could you even hear anything?
Yeah, I could hear him. Uh-huh. Okay. You know what's surprising is it was amazingly quiet for the size of the venue. This was right before humongous sound systems moved in, and it was almost like playing you remember when the Beatles played Shea Stadium?
Yeah.
And they were just playing with their Vox amps, and Ringo just had a drum set and they stuck a couple of mics down to it was like that. So we were playing on stage at like band volume, you know, so no monitors, nothing. So the band was mixing itself. It was just hit and run, you know, plug in and go. We didn't even take amplifiers. There was like a Fender Deluxe behind me. That's the lead player's amp. And so I was the lead player that night, and it's unbelievable. Yeah.
Did you learn anything out of that? Like, you know, about entertaining or anything at all?
Yeah. I mean, I learned that watching Roy, I learned one thing, is that you don't have to do a hell of a lot all the time to have incredible charisma. I learned that night that songs carry the enthusiasm. And it's great to have a live show and like people swinging on ropes and Kiss blowing stuff up. That's fantastic too. I mean, I like that too. I like the visual. But I'd never stood on stage with a singer that had that much control of their voice and that much charisma, just standing there singing, crying, and emoting. So I learned that, and I also learned that if I ever got to a big stage again, I needed to get my head together, right. You know. So I played all the licks I was supposed to. As a matter of fact, I somehow got through my whole part, but I don't think anybody was in more awe or wonder that night than me watching the whole thing from the stage. And I was standing 8 feet behind rope, you know, and yeah, it was amazing. I get chills now just thinking about it. But I had no idea at the time the magnitude of like what it was I was doing, you know.
What a great story, Mike. Thank you.
What was your experience like as a writer and then as a session player working with Kenny Rogers? That's another great icon.
I'll tell you what, it was very removed because I never even met Kenny until years later, after the song that I'd co-written with Michael Spriggs and Dan Tyler and Wood Newton had been recorded and had been a number one song. I never ran into him. And even playing on the any of the pre-production stuff for his record company, he wasn't there. He lived in Los Angeles. We lived here. And he was, at that time, he was like maybe the biggest star in the world. It's hard to imagine, but he was doing movies and he was everywhere.
Sure.
And anything he put out went to the top. So I didn't meet him. That was in 86. I didn't meet him until maybe 96.
Oh, wow.
Years later, yeah. And I met him because I was on tour in England with Don Williams, and Kenny Rogers was on the tour with us. And so I ran into him at a crew meal, and I said, "Kenny, I'm Mike Noble." He was a very accessible cat, very nice guy, and still is. And I said, "I'm Mike Noble. I wanted to thank you. I was one of the writers of 20 years ago." And I said, "That song bought my house in Franklin, Tennessee. And I just want to thank you." "Oh, great. I'm glad. Thanks." You know, and that was yeah. So that was, I didn't have any interaction with Kenny in those days. He got the song that a very astute publisher that at Warner Brothers had shot to him. He like overnighted in this song, and he said, with a follow-up message, he said, "This is something I really think you need to listen to, and I mean it, you know." And so somehow Kenny Rogers did listen to the song. And the funny thing was, is he called the guy back within 2 days in the morning, and he said, "I dreamed about this song last night. I'm going to record it."
Wow.
So that I don't know when he listened, but somehow during the next 48 hours, that song seeped into his dream, and I don't know what the dream was about, and he decided he needed to record it. And at that time, that was like having the biggest artist in the world record your song. It was huge. And
that's
it was
right.
Huge. Yeah.
And you wrote that song with Spriggs. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Spriggs. It was actually Spriggs' title. So,
you know, it's funny. He said something to me. We had it on his interview. He goes, "Oh, yeah, that's what I bought my house with." Same thing you had. I don't know if I didn't realize he was talking about the same song, probably.
Same song. Yeah. That's something that we shared together that's fantastic. And I mean, that's a real brotherhood. But yeah, I bought my house in Franklin. It made a difference in my life. And of course, it raised my visibility and all that kind of stuff. You have to have a song out there on the radio. What it does is it opens opportunities for other people to listen. They listen with different ears after you've had a hit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure, totally.
You're legitimized or something. And so, like, they're more willing to like your new songs if you just had a hit with Kenny Rogers. So that song did a lot of good. Yeah.
That's what past performance is a, you know, it's the opposite of when you do invest. Past performance is no indication of future performance, but that's not the case with music. Past performance, at least perception, is a strong indicator of future performance.
It is. And people listen with more favorable ears when you have a track record. And
yeah.
So that was a great track record to have. So it did me a lot more good than making a nice down payment on my house in Franklin. But anyway, yeah, but I never ran into Kenny, and I never ran into Kenny doing any work for his publishing company or his producer or anything either. He wasn't around. He was out touring, and he lived in Los Angeles, and we were here. So it was many years later that I finally got to thank him. And I think I thanked him again on that tour, and he was like, "I got it. Enough already."
Well, you're a young kid. You're just like, you know, to think that you'd have had an opportunity like that. I get it. You know, I would have been the same way.
He did a really, really nice thing when we were on that tour in England. When he found out that I was playing in Don's band, he inserted 20 years ago the song into his set, which he wasn't doing at the time. He's had so many hits that he would change his setup. He was doing whatever he wasn't tired of.
Sure.
So many hits. So when he found out I was on the tour, the last couple of nights of the thing, his guitar player, his band leader, told me to come out and said, "Watch the show tonight. Kenny's doing something." And I came out, and he did it live, and it was in a beautiful theater in England. And like, I got to watch him. I got to experience him sing my song live, or our song live, not mine, our song, and watch the audience react to it. And so it was a
That's a really cool thing to do.
It's one of the coolest things in the world.
Yeah.
There's Kenny Rogers. He's singing a song I co-wrote. in a packed house in England. Okay, this is unreal, you know.
That's really, I mean, but you know, something like that to me says a lot about a person when someone does, you know, a selfless, totally, you know, gratuitous towards you just to be kind. That was really cool, I think.
It says he has a big heart.
Yeah.
He didn't have to do that, and he didn't have to take notice of me. And I mean, I've seen other big stars backstage at crew meals, and there are some people that, you know, you just know they're, you don't go talk to them. You don't want to, you know. He was very accessible. Don Williams, who I was working for, is a very, very private person. He never came to a crew meal. It wasn't that he was unfriendly. He just didn't share that sociability. But Kenny liked it, you know. Yeah. So he was there, and you could walk up and talk to him, you know, and he was very accessible. So that was a very nice thing. So I've had, you know, I mean, I've had a lot of nice things happen to me, you know, in the music business. As a matter of fact, my experiences with everybody that I've met, from John Oates to Garth Brooks, these people, 99.9% of the time are kind and accessible. And if you have something to say to them, they're willing to talk to you. Hmm. They're just people. And it's been great, you know, and I get to meet so many interesting people these days. Like when I go to work, I'm playing with eight world-class musicians, interesting music in a great venue with, like, who knows who's coming through that night, you know, anybody. And so it's just the best job in the world. It's like I go off to fun, not work.
Sure. And that Steve Gibson he's the head of the Opry now, correct?
He's the MD of the Opry. So I have a relationship that goes back with him now 40 years that started with, he was one of the goobers I was hanging around with when he actually had something going on. The rest of us were just wannabes at that point. But he pointed me to a number of great things that have been great successes in my career. He got me the Lynn Anderson gig, and she was a big star in those days in the mid-70s because she had I Beg Your Pardon, I Never Promised You a Rose Garden, huge record. And he had played in her band for a while, and when he left, he said, call this guy from Illinois, Mike Noble, he'll do a good job. And she did, and I did. I stayed on that gig for 5 years. And that's the gig that got me. I don't want to spend my life on the road. I want to write songs. I want to be a studio musician. And if I keep doing this, I'll never get off the road. So I quit that gig in 1980. And I just said, I don't care. Whatever I got to do, I'm going to stay in Nashville and get to part two of this dream, you know, get to part two of this career. And so that's what I did. So
I give you credit, because that's always tough to do. Did you have, I mean, I know you had like the publishing contract, but you know, that's not there's no guarantees on that stuff.
And no money to start with.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, when I got off the road, what I did first is I worked manpower for a year.
What is that, like volunteer? Like, not volunteer. Sorry, it's like a manual labor stuff?
Yeah. Temporary manual labor. Right, so right. I was, you know, I had gone from like playing Harrah's Casino, the big room in Vegas, to like unloading trains downtown Nashville, you know. But I knew it was going to take some of that. So I did that for, I guess I did it for 9 months. But in the meantime, when I wasn't working and doing that and just trying to, you know, make minimum wage for a while to pay the rent, I was hanging around this small publishing company that I had some mutual friends with. As a matter of fact, Spriggs was hanging around at the same time. It was a little publishing company called House of Gold. And I was down there every day that I could be with my guitar all day long. There were writers. It was a beehive of activity, writing tunes, doing demos upstairs. There was all this stuff. And I'd sit around in the kitchen, and when somebody needed a guitar for a little guitar vocal demo, or somebody was working on a song and needed a little idea for an intro, I tried to make myself valuable. And after hanging around for a year, I actually got to the point where a couple of guys go like, well, let's see, you play guitar. You want to write an intro for this song? I go, yes, I do. And that got my foot in the door. So I did a lot of playing for free, a lot of hanging around. I made a lot of coffee and cleaned the kitchen a lot. And I always had my guitar available. And I could play the guitar better than most of these songwriters, which isn't saying much. Most of them could play three or four chords, and that's all they could do. So if they wanted to go do a nice guitar vocal, you know, just put Larry the song down with a nice guitar part, I'd go up and do it for free. They had a little 8-track studio upstairs. So I spent a lot of time there, and one thing led to another. Finally, I kind of minorly became part of the family. Finally, I got to talk to the head of the company. He said, I see you around here a lot. What is it you do? And I said, I write melodies and play the guitar. Well, play me something. I did. And he goes, okay. And got up the courage. And anyway, it led to my first writing deal, which was $60 a week.
Wow.
A year to write songs. This is 1981, 82. Wow. And anyway, that's where it started. Was I had a guaranteed contract. He paid me $60 a week just to write songs. I was doing other work also. I mean, manual work.
Yeah, yeah.
I had my $60 a week coming in, and I had a place to go that I could call my publishing company. And so within a couple of years, that led to more money, and it led to some success. And in 85, it led to a Steve Warner single. In 86, a Kenny Rogers single. And then it changed, and then I was legitimate, but it didn't happen overnight. That was the result of like trying to do nothing but write songs and learn to play on, you know, good demo sessions for 5 years, you know, before I finally hit with something. And I was down there all the time.
You know, yeah. One of the things that's so consistent and consistently impressive is that, as I said to you earlier, it's just like running a small business. The guys that succeed, that move to the top of the food chain in the music industry, people don't understand, you know, what it takes to do that. And
yeah.
I think that's a big myth in pop culture that, oh, you just went to Nashville and started playing. Mm-hmm. Not really.
Yeah.
And it's the same story for literally everybody. You got to suck a lot of wind like any other business.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, there is some being in the right place at the right time so a door can open. I mean, if I hadn't known Steve Gibson and he wasn't already doing, you know, fairly well and pointed me in the right places, I'm certain I would have stayed anyhow and found another way to do it. You know, but I mean, I did have that resource and it was good. But just because he referred me for something, then it was up to me to like earn the gig and keep it.
Yeah.
So
he opened the door, but you had to work to keep it open. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
So I learned a lot about live playing and playing concerts and stuff with Lynn Anderson, and I had the Dave Loggins. That's how I met Dave Loggins too. Was in Steve's living room when he was just sitting there playing his songs. He just moved there from Knoxville, and this was before he hit. He had a big pop hit in 73 or 4. Called Please Come to Boston.
Yeah, I remember that song.
I played with him for a couple of years on the road, and I jumped and did the Lynn Anderson gig. So I'd learned a lot about performing, and I did a lot of traveling, and I was gone a lot, and I played a lot of guitar, and I crisscrossed the country I don't know how many times, and I knew what that life was like, and there were parts of it that were really attractive, and there were parts of it that weren't good for me at that time, and there were... And also, I knew that I could probably end up doing that until, at that time, I thought I could be doing this until I'm 45, which seemed like ancient.
Yeah. Right.
And I still wouldn't, you know, I would still be gone this much going from one gig to another. So that's when I decided to make the jump and stay in town and really just go for being a songwriter and a studio musician. That's what I really wanted to do. So, so that's what happened. But I was an active part in making it happen. I mean, I had to give up that gig, which was a good gig, and it was a prestige gig, and like I said, I ended up at Manpower, you know, building office furniture and unloading trains. So, but it did give me an opportunity to stay around and try and make myself valuable at this little publishing company that I had found.
So it's always so impressive to me the things people do to pursue their art, you know. I mean, that's what you did. You were willing to go work Manpower. Now, there's anything wrong with it, but you're, But you're, but the change, the willing change to go from, you know, playing at a pretty nice gig to, you know, unloading trains is not easy. It may not be easy for certain people, you know, and you're willing to sacrifice it for the greater good of your art, and, you know, your dream to follow your passion.
Yeah, I just felt like if I stayed around long enough and made myself useful enough that door would open, and maybe I was, I don't know. I, it never occurred to me to leave. And a lot of guys came and stayed for a few months and maybe worked a gig or stayed for a year and did leave. It was too convoluted and too hard, I guess. But it never occurred to me to leave. And I just kind of figured if I kept knocking at it, you know, I'd knock it down, you know.
Sure.
And as far as the guitar playing, you know, the level of guys that I was trying to get in with and play with at this point, when I got off the road and tried to get into the Nashville studio scene, by the 80s, it was very sophisticated cats. The old guard, the old guys that were playing on all those records were still doing some playing, but there was a new breed of session player. Steve Gibson was one I happened to be one of them, younger guys that had fantastic facility on the instrument, that they were at another level of playing. And I knew that if I was going to compete with a Steve Gibson or play on sessions with him and the guys that were playing, I knew I had a lot of work cut out for me on the guitar. Because Steve is somebody that I realized the first time that he picked up guitar and I saw him address the guitar neck, he played something. It was, his touch was refined and beautiful. This is like a 22-year-old guy. And I went like, holy mackerel, I've never seen a guy play the guitar exactly like that with such finesse and such control. And I was still kind of, you know, hacking away at it. I could get some sound out of it, but I wouldn't call it pretty to look at. But I realized that Steve had been given a gift since he was very young, and that's how he played the guitar and held the guitar. I realized that if I was going to compete with Steve or play with him on equal ground, that I was simply going to have to outwork him. That was the only way that I was going to be able to come to the table. So that's what I set about doing, was I just outworked other people. You know, I think I had a certain aptitude for the guitar since I was a little boy. I took to it right away and I loved it and stuff. But when I saw Steve play the guitar the first time, I went like, okay, this is a new level of musicianship. And if I'm going to swim up here with these guys at this level, I'm going to have to up my effort, you know? And it's been that way ever since, Craig.
That's okay.
Yeah, it's been that way ever since. So
I've heard that story a lot with guys who come to town, little younger guys, and say, I went out to go see Brent Mace, and this is the most common guy. And
they
and after I saw Brent play, I questioned why I was in Nashville.
Yeah. A lot of people did, you know. I mean, you see a player like that, there are two types of people. They either give up and they go home and burn their guitars and just like are done with it, or they get depressed and then they get really busy.
Yeah.
Like, I've got a long way to go, you know? So I think the people that stay, they do the latter.
They dig deep and they say, I gotta make this work.
Yeah. So
you're from the Midwest, you said somewhere. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Cedarville, Illinois. It's right at the top of the state near the Wisconsin border. And it's about 50 miles south of Madison, Wisconsin.
Is that a small? Is it a city or a town? Or
no, it's a town of 600 people.
My God, 600 people! Oh wow, that's very tiny.
Yeah, and the biggest where I went to high school, there was a town that was 6 miles away that was 25,000 people. That was the big city.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's Freeport, Illinois, and that's where I went to high school and stuff. I went into Freeport for high school, but yeah, I went to grade school in a town. Yeah, I went to grade school in a 4-room. School building that had all 6 grades.
Wow. What was your childhood like growing up there?
A lot of outdoors, a lot of yard mowing and dishwashing. And my dad had a service station, a lot of washing windshields and pumping gas and sweeping floors. And a lot of camping out down by the creek, which was just a quarter of a mile away from my house. A lot of ice skating on that creek. So I spent a lot of time outside riding bikes, just kind of a normal 60s kind of upbringing of I look back now, it looks very idyllic in a way, you know.
It was
nice. And my dad was a mechanic. My mom worked at Sears, you know, and they both worked. And I have an older sister, a younger sister, and a younger brother.
So there's four of you guys.
Four of us. Very normal Midwestern 60s upbringing. Nothing spectacular. But I was already playing in bands by the time I was 13, and my mom and dad were extremely supportive of that that endeavor. They always supported my music interest, and they were way behind it, and My dad would help us haul our amplifiers to our little church gigs and dances and stuff like that. He had a van and he was very strong and he could lift, you know, two Fender Twins at once. Mm-hmm. And so they were very supportive. So I was doing gigs before I could had a driver's license and stuff. And so my dad would drive us to the gigs, drive the little band to the gigs, you know.
That's great. So, it's amazing how supportive the lion's share of the successful musicians I've interviewed. They had tons of support from the family, and they all, you know, hearken back to that, you know, that was critical to their success.
Yeah, and my mom was kind of pushy, actually. She was kind of a stage mom in the early days. By the time I was a teenager and stuff, I was already, like, I wanted to be in bands, and I wanted to play Beatles music, and I wanted to be part of the British invasion, go to England and all that stuff. But in the early days, she's the one that made me play, like, in a, when I was 9, in a talent contest that, you know, I was so nervous I got sick to my stomach and had a migraine headache. You know, she was like, get out there and play, you know, that song. And I go, Ma, I don't want to do it, you know. But
that's great.
She was pushy in the beginning. And anyway, she stayed pushy. I mean, even when she came and saw me with Dave Loggins and Don Williams and stuff like that, my mom, there'd be 10,000 people out there, and my mom would somehow find her way to the front of the line and get me out of the dressing room and say, your mother's here. Now get me back and see Don. I want my picture with Don. It was like, Mom, it's not that easy.
Oh, so, wow.
Stayed that way.
That's a great story. Did any of your brothers or sisters play music?
My brother plays music. My brother's a scientist, has been his whole career. He's a brainiac.
Wow.
But he plays piano and guitar for the sheer pleasure of it, and he loves music, and he's very good at what he does, but he plays for pleasure. My other two sisters, no. My sisters don't play or sing or anything. My youngest sister is a film and a television producer, so her creative side of the brain is with film and picture and dialogue. And my older sister was a hospice nurse most of her career. She's retired now, but she's a kind of an angel of mercy, one of those people.
That's a tough gig, man. Really tough.
So we're in all different parts of the country. My brother's in Madison, Wisconsin. My older sister's in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. And my little sister's in St. Petersburg.
Down here?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's funny. St. Pete's, I love St. Pete, man. It's a really cool place to hang out. Very cool, man.
So does she.
As far as tuition goes, you know, everybody in all of our careers will always pay tuition, and I was wondering if you'd be kind enough to maybe share one or two mistakes you might have made along your journey, and what were the lessons that you learned from them?
As far as my career choices or?
Well, yeah, you know, whatever, just like things that stick out at you that, you know, think, I've heard anything from, you know, I was underprepared for a gig, to I was too cocky for a gig, to, you know, I didn't show up on time once, you know.
Yeah. Well, listen, hey, I'll tell you, you know, being from the Midwest, showing up on time was never a problem, even if I had a hangover in the early days. I always managed to get there with the right clothes at the right place. But looking back on that time, I wish I changed anything, I would have gotten into songwriting earlier. I spent a couple of years on the road with Dave Loggins, who was a magnificent writer, and after he had his hit, and he never had anything really after that, he had an incredibly successful career writing hits for other people. And that's a career you can sustain. You don't have to go anywhere. I wish I would have taken advantage of, like, writing with him and learning more about the craft, as they put it, of writing when I was around him all the time. And I wish I would have gotten off of Lynn Anderson's gig earlier and, like, jumped into the scene here quicker. I was just scared. I was frightened to get off a gig because I had a steady income. And it's like you say, making that jump to, like, start part two of my career, I would have done that a couple of years earlier, because by the end of my time with Lynn, I wasn't doing myself any good out there on the road. I was playing the same gigs. I mean, she had great gigs. And she happened to be an artist that at that time, Fred Silverman at NBC Television was the head. He loved Lynn Anderson. And so she was on stuff like Hollywood Squares and Starsky and Hutch. She did television episodes and Dinah. And She was on all these cool television things.
Dinah, I haven't heard that in like.
Oh yeah, man, I did the show with her, man. I did the midnight special with her.
I haven't heard Dinah. That's like way back in the cobwebs of my brain. Yeah.
Yeah, Merv Griffin, and I'm not saying that I could have run through any opportunity. There were no opportunities there for me, but I got to see a lot. But it made it hard to jump off that gig. I wish I would have done it. But obviously, I got off at the right time because it worked out the way it was supposed to. But I wouldn't have stayed out there beating up the road so much because it didn't do my playing any good. It didn't do my songwriting any good. All it did was it paid my rent for a couple more years, you know, and made the car payment and kind of beat me up. By the time I got off the road, I think I weighed 128 pounds or something like that. It was not a good place for me to be. I wasn't doing myself any good. So I would have done that differently. But other than that, man, you know, I've never had a problem being prepared for a gig. I always prepared because I guess I've always had a fear of I never wanted to be that guy on stage that like take it and he didn't know his part. I've seen that happen so many times. I had a real fear of doing that. So I would over prepare sometimes, Craig. You know, you ever hear of a guy blowing a solo because they played it so much that they I have done that where take it and I played the solo so much that I couldn't play it when I needed it, I don't think so. I think I stayed pretty much true to time and I tried to always be prepared and provide. I was providing a service then, even if I didn't intellectually call it that. Sure. I knew my job was to make that person look good, and they were counting on me to lead them through this intro or take this solo or whatever. So I think it more has to do with timing and like making use of resources that were available to me that I was too stupid to see, you know?
But songwriting seems to be one of those things that when you're on the outside of it, it seems like it's one of those things that you almost need permission to do from somebody else who kind of does it and can get, you know what I mean? Because a lot of things, for myself included, you know, we all sometimes need permission or encouragement or something like that. And I think songwriting is such a unicorn in a sense that it's one of those things. You know, if someone had said to you, "No, I think you could do this and you should be doing this," I think that would have been, you know, that's probably a conduit that.
It's a help thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a sense when I was trying to write songs when I was 13, you know, I was trying to write tunes. It always occurred to me that it would be a cool thing to play songs, but it would be a cool thing to create a song and play that in front of an audience. It was something I wanted to do. So the idea wasn't foreign to me. Plus the guy that I come down here to see in Nashville had stopped playing. Basically, he just wanted to write songs. He was the bass player in our band and one of the lead singers. He was really, really good, but he just decided he wanted to concentrate on songwriting. And I went like, well, this is really interesting to make a life as a songwriter. But you're right. When I was hanging around House of Gold, when I was trying to stay in town and make and morph into a songwriter, not just a player. As a matter of fact, if I could have chosen at that time, I would have chosen being a successful songwriter over being a successful session player. To me, it was infinitely more interesting,
sure,
you know, and probably rewarding if you actually got somebody to record your song and it got on the radio. I mean, can you imagine what that would be like? And so when I was down there noodling with little melodies while someone was getting his coffee, trying to get their ear like, what's that? You know, how you do that kind of, I'll just do a little la-di-da-di-da-di-da. Oh, what's that you're playing? Oh, it's something I'm working on. I mean, really, that's how it went. And that's what happened for me is some guys that were having success, Stephen Pippen, Jim Hurt, Johnny Slate, Danny Morrison, Larry Keith, these are guys that you probably don't know that probably have written lots of songs that you do know. But anyway, they were on the charts. They were having success. They were sought after songwriters. Those guys were all in this little company at that time. It was a golden era at this time. And I got to be around them, and they were accessible also. If you had an interesting melody or an interesting title, if they weren't doing something else, they would work with you. and Larry Keith, and they did with me. Michael Spriggs as well. He'd tell you the same thing. It was he had the same mentors that I had. We were there because he was basically doing the same thing that I was. He'd gotten off the road with Eddie Rabbit,
right,
and was trying to stay in town and be a writer and a session player. That's why we've had a friendship for so long. We were both doing the same thing, and we were both mainly at this point. I was more an electric player. Well, so was he. We both became acoustic specialists somehow. You know, I guess there were too many Brent Mason types in town, and what they lacked was a really good, solid rhythm player. Sure. Nobody wanted to play rhythm. Lead's where it's at. Mm. You know, that's the Top Gun seat is like the lead player, and it still is on stage. You know, but I think Michael realized, and so did I, that there was a need for really solid rhythm player, foundation players. Mm. Somebody had to lay a bed to make those guys look good. And that's what I became, and that's what Michael became. We became acoustic players. And so when we both started playing sessions, or when I started playing sessions for other people via my own publishing demos, it was always as an acoustic guitar player because I wrote on the acoustic guitar. I didn't write on the electric.
Okay.
And I learned to become a very accurate finger picker, and I improved my rhythm and tuning, and my instruments played in tune and stuff, and that became valuable. That's how I got into the session business. I got in as an acoustic player, you know.
The guy you've referred to a few times who was in your band, is he still in town?
No, he isn't. And you know, I lost track of him. I haven't seen him for over 15 years, and he's long gone out of the music business. And His career kind of came to a he was a very self-destructive person, let me just say that. And finally, by the time he was in his 30s and we'd all been here 10 years, he kind of waffled off, and I completely lost it. He went underground.
Yeah.
So it's funny you ask about that, because I've been thinking about him a lot lately, and I have no idea where he is, and I don't think it's good, wherever it is.
Facebook.
I don't even know if he's on Facebook. Actually, one of our co-friends from that band is on Facebook, and I talked to him last week for the first time in a long time, and neither one of us know where this guy ended up.
It's too bad, man.
He was a wasted talent. It was a classic case of, you know, he's a self-destructive type and very gifted songwriter, great melody person. But anyway, no, I lost him.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Let's talk gear for a few minutes. So you're playing primarily acoustics now.
Primarily acoustic is what puts bread on the table.
What's your go-to guitar right now? Not the one you have to use, but the guitar you like to pick up.
I have a guitar that was made by a maker in Kansas named Leo Posch, P-O-S-C-H. He's a one-off maker. It's an OM body style acoustic, and it's my favorite guitar. It's balanced, it's brilliant, it's got plenty of body, and it plays beautifully. And the guitar itself is flaming maple, and this guy just does incredibly beautiful work. Leo Posch, that's my go-to guitar. My backup one that's close behind it is a Martin D18, and it's a brand new one of the series that George Gruen is handling called the Sinkers, where they managed to get up a barge load of wood in where was it? Not Honduras. But anyway, they got up a load of sunken mahogany from Central America. Martin bought the wood. It had been underwater for 120 years, and it was probably 50 years old then. They dried it. They've made a series. They've made a limited number of D18s, they made a couple of other models with it. And George Martin comes out to the Opry all the time. He owns, you know, Gruen Guitars, which is one of the best vintage places in the world. He drags these guitars out there and says, boys, play the guitars. See what I've got. And so he drug about 20 or 25 different of these D18 sinkers out there that have been made of this sunken wood that was dried. Anyway, he made me a believer. I bought one. And I love it. It's a fantastic guitar, and it's a classic D18 with a wide chunky neck and that D18 dreadnought sound. Those are my two favorite acoustics. by and far. And really, I don't even play anything else anymore. They both feel great in my hand.
I didn't know George Martin owned Gruen.
I mean, not George Martin, George Gruen.
George Gruen, yeah, okay.
I had the Martin guitar, I'm
sorry. Yeah, okay. George, I was like, Gruen. Wow, that's interesting. Okay. Yeah.
George Gruen brought Martin's out.
Yeah, okay. There you go. It's all right.
So, but this Leo Pasch is as good as anything I've ever played. And so if you don't know who he is, I would suggest you get on his website because he's an interesting, lovely man that's just out in the middle of nowhere in Kansas making beautiful guitars.
How'd you get turned on to him?
There was a guy that was out there playing with a bluegrass group that was playing one of Leo's guitars. And bluegrassers know how to find guitars. You know, it's kind of like a religion with them, and I understand it. I guess it's like a religion with me, frankly. I shouldn't be talking, but he was playing this.
That was a very appropriate admission.
he was playing a guitar that I hadn't seen before, and he was just getting an incredibly bell-like tone out of it, and it was a Leo Pasch Dreadnought, D18 kind of size. I said, who's Leo Pasch? Oh, this guy in Kansas. I'll tell you what, I'm going to put Leo in touch with you, and he'll contact you. And I said, fine, I'd love to talk to him. So it ended up that Leo Pasch contacted me. He happened to be coming through Nashville on his way to a guitar show in North Carolina with 12 of his guitars. He said, I'll come out to the Opry and I'll bring you all of the guitars I'm making. I'd like you to see them and play them. He schlepped in 12 or 15 guitars into the backstage at the Opry one night, and he said, I was thinking, after talking to you, I was thinking of this OM and be one that you would like. And so, to make a long story short, I played it. I fell in love with it immediately. And it was just one of those special guitars that has clarity and balance. And it just has everything you want to hear when you just strum a chord, you know, finger pick, you know. And he said, I'd like you to just, if you like that, I'd like you to just hold on to that guitar forever, as long as you want. I still have it. That was a couple of years ago, you know, and so I play it all the time. And, he likes the exposure and I like playing his guitar. And so it's one of those small guy company kind of stories. But I wouldn't play it if I didn't love it. And I love it every time I play it. So he
basically endorsed you and you got the guitar to play. Yeah. And that's wonderful. Yeah. Good for you. Good for him. And man, as sincere as you are, because, you know, it's funny when you were sitting, I was like, wow, this guy is really passionate about this guitar. Is all you have to do is talk 5 minutes to three other guitarists, and this guy's going to sell guitars. So, which is great.
Well, I would like to turn on some people to the work that this guy is doing by himself. Like I said, he's in a remote part of Kansas. He's out there kind of just making these beautiful, they're pieces of art, and they're practical too. I've done this. I've taken this guitar all over the place in all kinds of situations and weather and theaters and stuff like that. And it's completely held up. So it has girth, you know. It's not just beautiful. It's not dainty, you know. So I've put it through the pieces. But the D18 Sinker, I love that guitar as well, and I'm getting used to it. And I play that sometimes, but my go-to guitar would be the Leo Pasch, absolutely.
Awesome. Has your playing, you know, changed maybe in the last 5 years? And the reason I ask that is because, I know as a person, people are always trying to improve.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine as a player, you're always trying to improve. I was curious if you have had any kind of changes in your playing over the last 5 years. If so, what would those be?
Yeah, I have. I've had a couple of big changes in my playing. It started when I went from being just a totally live player and playing shows and mostly electric guitar to when I really wanted to become an acoustic session player by being extremely mindful of touch, string noise, time. Things that you don't have to think about when you're playing in a hootenanny and you're playing for your friends and go like, oh, Mike can play, you know, Simon and Garfunkel. Listen to how good he is. That's one thing. Playing under a microscope in a studio and trying to make a perfect performance for a record that's going to be kept forever or for a demo or whatever it is that you're hired to do is a totally different mindset. So I really started to improve my posture, for one thing, for sitting in the studio for a long time. Keeping my back straight. I always started wearing a strap all the time, even when I was sitting down, so I would address the guitar in the same way. I know these things sound stupid, but I mean...
No, not at all.
Swing. You do it time and time and time again. When I address the guitar, my back is straight. I put my strap on. It sits perfectly on my lap. And I have the same angle on the neck. And so my hands, they know where the sweet spots are. Okay? So that was the first change. The next change, that went on, and I kept refining that, but I got to a point where it was very comfortable for me to play the guitar properly and in good time. And I could pick out the notes that I wanted. I started to refine my right hand as well and my strumming style to make that even, because we have a thing here when you're playing rhythm in a studio situation, so there's sometimes you're banging on it and it's very, you know, acoustic Bob Dylan-y or Bruce Springsteen-y bang bang feeling, or Neil Young. And there's other times that what you're putting on, it's almost like windshield washers. It has to be that ching 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 ching, even every stroke.
Very straight. Is that
very straight? And you're laying a foundation for other things to lay on top of it, and it's the brick and mortar of the foundation. So anyway, I learned to do that. The next thing that happened to me is I hit 50 years of age and somebody had given me a Johnny Smith record for Christmas. Great jazz guitar player. All my career, I had avoided jazz. I didn't really know anything about those chords and those tunes. I didn't really care that much. My parents listened to some of that music. And the only times that I'd ever run into jazz guys on sessions, to be frank with you, they were very snobbish. And I went like, you know, I don't care about you and your jazz. You can go jump off a cliff.
Yeah, yeah.
You're to do what I do. You do your jazz sharp five thing and I don't care, you know. And I stayed that way for 25 years. I was coming home from a demo one night. There used to be this demo factory, not factory, demo studio, but it worked so much it was like a factory. They just had bands and shifts, and they just did demo after demo after demo. And I'd done two sessions there that day, and a lot of the songs that I played that day were very repetitious. It's like I played the same song 13 times, but, you know. So I was worn out, and I was on the drive home, and on the floorboard of my car, I'd seen that this Johnny Smith record, this jazz record that I'd never opened even. This is in March. I never opened it from Christmas. Was laying there, and I wanted to get the last song out of my head of a session. So I opened this thing at a stoplight. I put it in my CD player, and this sounds ridiculous. A mile and a half later, I had to pull over on the side of the road because I was so enthralled by what I was hearing this guy do on the guitar. I stopped the car, and I went like, I've been playing the guitar since I was 9. I have no idea what he's doing. I know it's a guitar. I don't know what he's doing. I don't know any of those chords. I don't know any of that technique. That started a journey for me that's ongoing, and that's interest in playing jazz guitar. And that may be, whether that's boring or interesting to a lot of people, that's exactly, Craig, what I needed at that time in my life, because I was grateful, but I was working so much in the studio that I wouldn't say I was losing my enthusiasm, but I mean, I was doing the same thing over day after day after day. Glad to be there, glad for the experience, glad to be in a studio with great musicians, playing somewhat interesting songs, but like I was going nowhere.
You lost the fun aspect of it.
I lost the thrill or the inspiration to it. I mean, I was playing at a level that was fine for what I was doing. I wasn't shortchanging anybody. I didn't start showing up late and play sloppy, but I wasn't going anywhere. And I needed something to inspire me, you know. And this CD at that time, on that drive, on that day, started a whole new world for me. And that was to learn how Johnny Smith was playing solo guitar pieces on his big jazz box, his big L5, how he was doing, and he actually had his own model, but an L5 Gibson, how he was making the guitar sound like that. And I wore that record out. I started going out at night. I was going around to see, like, who were the jazz guitar guys in Nashville. Nashville, it's not a jazz town, but the fact of the matter is it is a jazz town. There are cats that can play here. There are guys that can play everything, and they're here. I just had never really looked. I'd never been part of that scene. So I started going out and looking at guys that called themselves jazz guitar players and seeing quartets and seeing big bands and seeing trios. And I ran into a guy that was playing at a trio one night at this small club called Cafe 123. It was him, a B3 organ, and a drummer playing a cocktail kit, you know, the tiny little yep. kit. And he was playing a big, big fat Gibson guitar. And he was as short as I am. And he was wearing it out. And I mean, it was the most interesting. And they were playing like jazz rock. Some of this was like 12-bar blues kind of jazz stuff with changes. He was playing the most interesting solos over in the key of A that I'd ever heard. He was using notes that I didn't know were, you know, I was listening to Stevie Ray Vaughan, you know, or and Clapton. That's sure. what you put in, you know, an A jam. You put that stuff in there. He was doing really something else. And so after his set, I went up to him and I introduced myself. I didn't even tell him I was a session player or a songwriter. I just said, my name's Mike. Do you give lessons? And he said, yeah, I teach out of my house. And he gave me his card. And within the next 2 days, I called him up and set up a lesson. And I went over and took a bunch of lessons from Mel, and I took a half dozen lessons. His name is Mel Deal. Great. All around, he can play Brent Mason style too. It's just that he can play the jazz. Hmm. He can play solo or swing or bop or angular or whatever, any style that you want. He'd been studying it already for 25 years. But anyway, the time I met him, I went over and I took a half dozen lessons from him before I even told him I played sessions. He didn't really know what I did because I was embarrassed to tell him that I was making a living as a studio musician and I didn't know what he knew on guitar.
Oh,
I was,
that's impossible.
That was a different thing. But no, I was, I mean, yeah. I felt going like, you know, I'm doing really well playing this instrument. What the hell are you doing? Yeah. You know, idea. So he was the guy that led me personally from playing like rock, jazz, country style changes, hearing it that way, to hearing it in more of a jazz way with like more of the jazz melodies and stuff. And that started a journey for me that I'm still on, man. If you look over here at my music stand, what I've got is like the biggest fake book, what they call the fake book sure. in the world is the Book of Tunes. And like, you know, I learned those tunes. I learned to play them by myself. I learned to play them in it. And most of the time, the only person that hears me play jazz is my wife while she's downstairs. Because I don't have an outlet for what I'm doing. I sure. do something else. And I'm never going to move to New York. And there's no scene left in New York anyway. That happened in the 50s and
not 60s. Not many guys. I mean, there's yeah. some guys left there, but it's not really a lot of clubs. It's not a lot.
Yeah, there's not. They don't exist. And so in some ways, man, you know, when I got into learning jazz, and it opened up a whole new world of tonality for me in chord progression and tunes and melody and style of playing and tone, and it's been fascinating, and it still is. I have a couple of guys that I play with out at the Opry that are in the Opry band that are good jazz players, and a lot of times between performances, when they don't need us out there on stage, we'll be cracking Autumn Leaves or you know, Autumn in New York or something. We're playing the fake book back there to kind of keep it going, because sure. if you don't play that music, you lose it. It's like anything. If you don't use it, you lose it. So we try and keep our reading, our technical reading chops up, and we try and play some tunes. But I'm no jazzer. I'm a jazzer wannabe, I guess. But I do like to play jazz music, man. And so that's cool. That's been an ongoing thing. So it's changed. But you know what? That was a long way to tell you what you asked me. It improved my technique in ways that I didn't think needed improving. But actually, just as far as economy of motion.
Hmm.
Economy of motion in getting to a lick, and licks that I used to play that like I would not struggle with, but they were difficult for me and they'd always be a bump in the road. This playing this way, I actually, when I started trying to play jazz style on my electric guitar, I bought a big jazz box. I ended up changing the way I held my pick. So after 40 years, I started to hold my pick differently so I could execute some of the things I wanted to do with my right hand. And so that refined my right hand even more. I used to have kind of a sloppy right hand. I'd play with the pick between my thumb and first finger, but I let my other fingers kind of, and you see a lot of guys do this, I just like let them hang down or kind of, you know, counterbalance. And I actually took the time, and it took me over a year to do it, to hold my right hand like I was holding a roll of quarters and hold the pick in between my thumb and first finger and use the corner instead of the tip of the pick.
Gotcha.
And so I changed the way, and it changed the way that I moved my wrist and elbow, and it's better. So anyway, that's changed.
Great. So you've had some like pretty good growth out of this as a player professionally.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing was I'd been at the same speed ceiling probably since I was 25. I mean, you get to a certain – unless you're playing bluegrass all the time, and that isn't what I was doing. I've had one – I have one bluegrass solo that I've been using for 25 years. You know, very, very seldom do I have to play that stuff on a session. But if I did, I had one that I worked out when I was 25, and I was still using it at 49. So I was at a certain – level of speed. It just seemed like I could get to a certain speed, and then after that, like guys like Steve Lukather or whatever, like they lost me. I could only get to a certain point. But this actually increased when I changed my pick technique and the way I held my right hand. My speed went up probably 20%.
Oh, that's quite a bit.
It is, and so I can play. And the thing is, I don't do it. I'm older now. I'm not interested in playing that fast. But if I need to push the pedal down, I've got it, and it's because I changed my right hand technique. I made it a lot more economical, and spending a lot of the energy touching the sounding the string and not moving my hand, if that makes any sense.
I smell info product: how to increase your right hand speed by 20% in 30 days or less by Mike Noble.
Okay, well, I have the, you know, I've personally gone through it, so I can tell you how to do it. I've also, it's interesting, because of that jazz journey, all the cats that I was working with in the studio while I was still, they knew that I was getting into jazz, because they'd come into the session early and I'd be practicing in my room to get ready. I'd be practicing some Jim Hall thing I was working on. And so it's led to actually several guys actually calling me up humbly after a couple of years and going like, I'm trying to learn to play kind of in a jazz. These are guys that are like immensely successful guitar players. And I don't know how to get from playing like Eric Clapton or Stevie Ray to, like, I want to play like Tal Farlow. I don't know where to start. And I'd say, come over to the house. I'm going to show you what Mel showed me. Or I'd send him to Mel. He was the perfect pilot to get me through, like, playing rock blues style, which I still love. I love to hear a guy that can wear that stuff out. It's fantastic. You know, it's soulful. I dig it. But I also like the guys that, like, take that 12-bar thing and do something really different with it and play more like a horn player. Because that's what those guys were trying to emulate.
Definitely.
The cool, cool notes. I call them the tier notes, man. Tiers, you know.
Very tier cool. Notes. Yeah, man.
And so I've helped a few guys, like, try and get to the other side. Because you get locked into a certain harmonic sense, and you've been doing it since you were a kid. Or you love rock music, or you love pop music, or you love this music. That's the way you hear it. But if you want to get to something else that has... I don't even want to say more sophistication. It does in a way, because it uses more changes, but it uses more chord extensions. You don't really know how to get there. You find your hands going back to the same things. When you play a jam in A, this is what I play. You play a jam in E, this is what I play.
Sure.
You know? So to get out of that and to get into something else and try and play unlike yourself, I guess that's what all artists are doing. If I was a painter, I'd be trying to paint unlike myself. My paint.
It's called growth. That's why. Yeah, that's why I asked you that question. That's good, man.
Yeah.
Mike, what's something you've learned about yourself along this life journey?
Well, as I've gotten older, it's changed. I've learned that I'm not afraid to take on a challenge, and I'm not afraid to do the work necessary to be successful. These are, you know, I guess as you get older, you learn what the chinks in your armor are and what your strengths are, and you get more comfortable with it. Somewhere in my 40s, my late 30s, I think I stopped trying to play like other successful acoustic players that were doing really well, like Steve Gibson or Biff Watson or somebody else. I stopped trying to sound like them and got okay with sounding like how I sound.
Like Mike. Yeah.
And it was the first time I can remember ever on a session, I could never imagine doing this, that if we were playing in a situation and the producer of the session said, like, okay, I need this on that for the first time ever, I have actually said, look, that's not, I don't do that very well. If you want that guy, you should get that guy. This is what I do better. You know, I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but that's not what I do. And every time they'd go like, well, just do what you do. I finally got all right with just saying, this is what my strengths are, and I'm not good at this, but I can do this. You don't say that very often on a session, but I mean,
sure.
In a particular instance. So that's something I would have never done in my youth. I would have been scared to death, tried to do it anyway, and probably failed. I did that, you know, not measure up. Somewhere in my late 30s, I got comfortable with my own playing, and I started to see the difference between what I did and what the other guys did was something that was valuable to some people, you know.
Sure.
That's why I was there. And that's still the case today. I mean, I'll take on a challenge. If there's some speed demon thing that I'm supposed to play, I will try and play it. But, you know, if I get to a point where I'm uncomfortable and I feel like I'm going to make myself look foolish and let the artist down, I will now tell them.
Right.
And say, I'm not the guy for that. I guess I'm, you know, finally, this sounds a little dramatic, like I have issues. Now I'm finally okay with...
We all have issues.
Yeah, I'm finally okay with how I've gone about it, what I do, what I choose to do, and how I go about it. I'm okay with it, you know? And that's been a process, because even when you're working a lot as a musician, there's always somebody that's working more or bigger dates. And I've gone through these phases where I go like, well, I need to network then. I need to plug in. And any time I've ever tried to do any of this, that kind of thing where to jump my head ahead, self ahead of the next guy and get up to the next level or whatever, I say things that I'm not good at that. I don't, yeah. That's not me. And so,
Well, being passionate and pursuing something you enjoy got you where you're at, and that's the right formula to follow.
Right. And so that's what I'm continuing with. And so I guess at this point in life, it's finally a relief to be with, okay, this is what I need to do. This is what I'm doing. This is how I go about it. And it's worked so far, you know, and it's still working. And now I'm older than I thought I would ever be, and I'm still strumming a C, A minor, F, and G, you know, so... I'm the luckiest guy on the planet.
Well, hey, man, it's working for you.
Yeah.
Tell me something about yourself, Mike, that people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
They might find odd is that, well, you know, playing the guitar is very sedentary. Part of my being a successful guitar player has been the fact that since I was 30 years old, I decided that I was going to stay fit.
Yeah, you're extremely fit, actually. Yeah, you look like you're like very, like you put effort into taking care of yourself.
I do.
Yeah.
And so part of improving my guitar playing has been physical, staying fit physically. Because you can't sit on you can't do 9 hours of this and go home and eat pizza and fall asleep to reruns of Hazel and expect to
live
virtually.
So, between Hazel, was the other one you said, Hazel? And what was the other
Reruns of Hazel.
No, but the other show you said earlier. Not Oprah.
Dinah.
Dinah. This is like a walkthrough WPIX or something like that.
Yeah, I know it. So staying fit physically has been part of like improving my guitar playing because it clears my mind mentally. And I think a lot of guys miss this. Like, guys mean to stay in shape. And when you get really busy, it's really hard to stay in shape. And I'm not talking about 2-hour fitness marathons. I'm talking about getting to the gym a few times a week and getting, you know, running for 30 minutes or getting on the whatever, spinning for 30 minutes or doing something just to kind of clear things out, let the notes move out of your head. So physical fitness has been a part of my success as a guitar player and a songwriter. I can't tell you, Craig, how many songs I've finished while I've been running 6 miles out of Percy Warner Park. Dozens and dozens and dozens of songs. It came to me like I put the guitar down. I stepped away from the guitar. I got out of the house and put on my running stuff, even though I didn't want to go. I went and ran those hills. And, you know, by mile two, I went like, I've got the second verse. It's come to me, you know. Done that many, many times. And I don't know if that's that odd, but I think it's something that people overlook, that all of these disciplines that we're trying to manage and accomplish work together. You know, I studied karate for a really, really long time, and that there's that kind of Eastern sensibility, and it's not so Eastern anymore. I mean, it's been in the West since the show Kung Fu was on. It's like somehow the mind, spirit, and body work together.
Yeah.
I absolutely believe that. Like when I'm in a good spiritual, in a grateful phase, instead of looking at what's wrong with everything and how stupid everybody is, and I've had those phases, in being thankful for the fact that I can still do this, having a positive attitude with as cliche as it is, with the half is glass, the glass is half full, it's not half empty, get myself to the gym, take care of myself, watch what I eat, and then practice, I get more going on. My practice is better. My playing is better. And even if I'm too tired to go to the gym, I go to the gym, I get energized, I come back, and like whatever piece of music I'm trying to conquer, I kick its butt.
Absolutely.
You know? I come back with that... I come back with readiness, you know, so I don't want to sound like I'm a saint. I'm not by any means. I have plenty of weeks where I've been too busy to go to the gym and I've just schlepped around. But that's been an ongoing part of my guitar playing and songwriting has been to stay fit physically. And I stopped doing karate finally when I was the oldest guy in the gym and, you know, I can only fight so many 25-year-olds without like busting a finger, which I did. I broke a shoulder once, so that kind of...
Yeah, that's not a good recreational hobby for someone that plays professional guitar, yeah. No, I agree with you at the gym, man. I was just there this morning. In fact, before I got on the phone with you, my wife called me. She says, I was just down about something this morning. She goes, hey, you feeling better? I said, oh, yeah. She knew right away if I went to the gym.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, of course I'm feeling better. I went to the gym, I worked out, and that's not an immaterial issue because I feel better.
Yeah.
You know, my mind was, like you said, energized. And I think a lot of people would feel better and probably live a lot longer if they just did some basic stuff like that.
Yeah, and it's there's no downside to it. And the other thing that people might they probably wouldn't be surprised about, but I would say at this point in my life I could be classified as I am a hopeless romantic.
Yeah, that's good, man.
Romantic person, and I think it comes out of my playing and stuff like that when it's allowed to. Go to the site that I finally gave you the right title to. If you just skim a few of the songs, you'll. I liked playing this kind of mood board music because it let me, you know, emote something for 35 seconds or something that I was feeling at the moment, and then move on to something else, as opposed to sitting there and doing a 3-minute and 30-second song of just, you know, windshield washer. And I love that too because that's a skill, you know. That's a skill to do that, but this was something that was totally different. And I found myself sitting at my studio here with these tracks that my friend had sent me and going like, well, what is it that I do feel? What do I feel? You know, what am I feeling? Besides I have to get the oil changed and the tires rotated, what am I feeling today? and I think this project that's up online is evidence of like some real good snapshots of mood and emotion and good tone and good technique. I'm proud of it, you know, and there's a lot of different styles on there, so I got to do a lot of different things. I've been studying flamenco guitar for the last year or so with a guy at Belmont named Mario da Silva in my continuing journey to find things to do. And I don't know how I got turned on to Paco de Lucia years ago in the 70s when he came on the scene, but in the last couple of years, he's appeared on my radar, and I've watched videos and stuff of him playing the guitar, the flamenco style. Mm. It's another one of those things where, like, I have no idea how do they do that, you know? So instead of just messing around on YouTube this time, I actually found out who knows how to do that, and I've gone and spent some time with him. So I spent a lot of my evenings up here after my wife has fallen asleep because she has to get up so early in the morning to go teach school, and I stay up late. I sit up here and put on, you know, a spy movie or something and mindlessly go over these flamenco techniques. That's what I've been doing lately. So
very cool. Well, I want to talk. I'm going to ask you three questions and I want to talk about your project you mentioned a minute ago.
Okay.
That's okay with you. Most important person in your life?
right now is my wife, Erin C. Glass. She is the most important person in my life.
And you guys have been together how long?
We have been married 7 years, and we've been together 8 years.
Congratulations, man. And I hope you have another...
make that 9 years. I don't want to get that wrong.
Yeah, she's going to listen to this.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, congratulations, and I hope you have many more years, good years together to come.
Thank you.
Toughest decision you ever had to make, or the hardest thing you ever had to do?
That's easy. That was walking out of my house that I'd been living in for 20 years and out of a 30-year marriage.
Yeah, man, that's a very tough thing to do, and I give you credit for doing that. That is, and there, you know, the tough thing about that is, at least it was for me, there's no, I mean, getting married is tough enough because, you know, it's new, but it's a natural thing. When you unwind that thing, it's very unnatural.
Yeah. Well, it was disorienting. At the same time that I made that decision for each of us to go our separate ways as amicably as possible, it was also a period of time where my work as a session player dropped dramatically in that first 6 months. So all of a sudden, I was like disoriented because I not only wasn't living where I'd been living for 25 years with the same person, I was sleeping on friends' couches. I had a suitcase in my car, and all of a sudden I wasn't working very much. Mm. And it just was like it all happened at once. I mean, I was the architect of all of this, sure. Not the work dropping off, but the fact that it coincided with my division with my ex-wife. It was just like, it was more than what the young people say, a reality check. It was too real, but yeah. Anyway. So that was a time to really regroup and circle the wagons and figure out what it is, who I wanted to be, what I wanted to do, where I felt like I belonged in the universe, and like, you know, what was the reason to go on? What are we doing now? You know, so anyway.
You know what?
That was the first thing.
I read a book one time. It was called Finding Your North Star. And I read it at a point in time when it was just not divorced, but I had a lot of open loops.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of bad shit had happened. And some of it, which I was the architect of. And when you're in that rudderless situation, it's very disturbing because, like, you know, we're goal-seeking people, but that sure. is sort of like snap. You know, the cord is cut. And this book said one thing that I'll never forget. It was the best advice I ever had, and I've given it to my sons and my buddies in situation. It said, you know, when you're going through something like that, it's not really a good time to think about retirement, savings. You know, but I was like, you know, that's really, thank you. I was so happy I read that. You know, live in the moment, focus on getting through the moment, and that other shit will come into place when it's meant to come into place. Because, you know, it's like telling a five-year-old to put money in an IRA. It's just not a good time, not a good place, you know?
You know, you're exactly right, because those things come across your mental horizon. You're going like, what have I done? But the only way to get through it and survive and then thrive is exactly what you said. And that's just present tense living.
Yeah.
Just the moment. This is what I have. This is what's going on right now.
Right.
The past, I can't do anything about. And the future is uncertain. So it always comes with a little anxiety. But right now, in this moment, I'm fine. Right. Everything's okay. It's cool. You know, and that's how the first year was, you know.
And it's tough. And I've had a lot of guys, another good piece of advice, I had a lot of buddies and just people I've known go through like a 12-step program. And the other thing that they say in that program is just focus on doing the next right thing.
Yeah.
And that's
I'm a graduate of that program, so.
There you go. So focus on doing the next right thing, man.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of wisdom in the programs that go way beyond addictive behavior.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know? It's just successful living.
It really is.
I mean, the AA programs absolutely saved my life, and I walked through that front door 33 years ago, and it's been a different story ever since. So,
man, well, you've had a lot of successes.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I guess that's one we didn't delve into. I mean, I guess I alluded to it in my 20s and stuff. I had that self-destructive behavior too, which is very common to 20-year-olds in general and 20-year-old musicians certainly, but. anyway, I'm so thankful that I was able to get it turned around.
Good for you, man. I'm happy too. Happy for you.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you one last question, then I want to talk about Rogers Noble. What's the best advice you've ever been given? And maybe that we just covered it. And who gave it to you?
It still goes back to this. As maudlin as it sounds and stuff, I still do not veer away from follow what you love. Do what you dream. I don't veer away from it, even in this weirdly controlled economic level, high pressure world we're living in, where everything has to be instantaneous, and if you don't reach success in 6 months, you get out and you do something else, you switch gears. I mean, I see so many, I run into so many people that are music students at Belmont, but their major is accounting or music business or music law or music marketing, and it's because they love to play the violin, but their parents want them to have a real job fallback position. They're doomed to, they'll never be musicians.
Mm.
And not that it's not smart to have a fallback position. It is. But if I'd have had a fallback position when I was here, I'd be the manager of Pabst Blue Ribbon or something at this point in time.
Right.
Or, you know, I'd be managing three Walmarts or a tire store. I was out there on the edge. It never occurred to me to leave. I have no backup plan, and maybe that isn't smart, but in other words, I had no choice. I had to follow through. And I think that, and I've known guys, and you have too now, that, you know, you know guys that you've known since high school that went into an insurance business or did something that they followed this or they followed their father's business, and they've had 30 terrible years of hating to go to work every day, but they've had a job in health insurance. And that's,
yeah.
I know that's great, but they hate it every day. The thing is I haven't loved every day that I've gone off to work or got on a bus to go on the road. But you know what? I always had that magic 75 minutes where I was on stage with somebody that was being adored. I mean, it's amazing. And it's taken me all over the world. So I tell my son this. My son is 33. He's regrouping right now. He's been in Los Angeles for 10 years. He went to school for film. He's a musician. He's a physical artist as well. And it's hard to make a living doing these things, you know. So he worked in a bookstore and he does his art on the side, and he's launched his own record label and he plays a few festivals. And well, tomorrow he's going on tour for 2 weeks to Japan. He's an electronic music guy.
Good for him. That's great.
He's toured Europe by himself 3 times, which is way more courage than I have to get up there by yourself and do 27 dates in 35 days in Europe. Here's your train ticket. You know, he's done that. But I still tell him, you know, he's thinking about going back to graduate school and trying to get something that's more legitimate or whatever than just working in a bookstore and making his music. And I still tell him, if you go to grad school, that's fantastic, but like, do what you love. It's like you said when we started the conversation, you're only here once, you know, and you're going to do what you love or don't love for a long time. So I still say, follow what you love. Follow what you love and let the chips fall where they may. And as much as you can, live in the present tense and enjoy the journey. You know, I've enjoyed more than I deserve. You know, I've met more interesting people and been more interesting places and played notes than anybody should. And yet I wouldn't have it any other way, you know?
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that, man. That's really good advice. Let's talk about your new project. First of all, tell me where to find it. It's Rogers Noble, R-O-G-E-R-S, Noble, N-O-B-L-E, as in Mike Noble, .persona.co.
Yes.
Online.
That's exactly right. RogersNoble.persona.co/. And what it is it's a collaborator friend of mine, my favorite keyboard player, piano player. His name is Tyson Rogers, who's now living in Crested Butte, Colorado. He's a lucky fella. He's out there snowboarding, I'm sure, while we talk, because he's a snowboarding nut. But anyway, he's also a phenomenal piano player and a synthesizer whiz. Gets more interesting sounds out of synthetic music than anybody I've ever heard. And we collaborated together on sessions when he lived in Nashville for 10 years. He left 3 years ago, and we did a lot of sessions together, mostly in East Nashville, which is kind of the cooler, hipper part of town these days. It's the in place. Music Row isn't, East Nashville is, but he was part of that scene. also a very deep jazz player. But anyway, he moved away and we've missed playing with each other. So he decided that he was going to start sending me small snippets of electronic music that he had created and see what I would do with them. One thing led to another. And so via email and stuff, we both have our little electronic studios. He would send me a track. I would add guitars and bass, anything guitar string oriented, send them back. He would mix them up. And we created 26 pieces of what we feel are perfect pieces for television, movies, commercials, whatever. I mean, you know, music is everywhere. It's the background of everything. So I guess it's us just throwing our collaboration into the business of trying to get some TV music, some themes, some background music. I don't care whether it's a chase scene or a Hunt's ketchup commercial, you know, something. Sure. Just another way to make music. You know, it's another way to make music. And so we ended up doing 26 complete pieces, mixed them. And so we launched a website, and my son Lee, who's the artistic son I was talking about, added artwork to our music. So it's kind of it's a audiovisual mood board. Let's just call it that. It's a mood board. And so if you go to this website, hopefully you'll have a pleasant watching, listening experience. And maybe this is the future of albums, Craig. Albums in the future, even if you're watching on your phone, is like, you not only hear the music with a 2-minute video for the single, you see a lot of images, you know, you see, and it's an experience, you know. And I hope that this is a listening and a mood altering experience that's safe.
Well, everybody check it out if you're looking for what's that
possibly, hopefully addictive, but safe
addictive. Yeah, check it out. It's at rogersnoble.persona.co /, and if you're looking to license tracks, you can get a hold of Mike as well.
Yeah,
man, I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate all the interesting questions, man. You're way more prepared than I was, and I'm impressed. I appreciate it. It's been great talking to you.
Likewise, man. I appreciate it.
It's always interesting talking about music, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks so much, man. Hey, everybody. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. I want to thank again to Mike Noble for spending all his time with us. I appreciate it. And go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes along with some cool stuff we have. And remember, happiness is a choice. So be nice, go play your guitar, and most important, have some fun. That's what it's all about. Till next time, peace and love, and I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.